Today is September 23rd, 2019, and this is Shitpost. On this episode of Shitpost, we've got not one, not two, but three great interviews for you to enjoy. But before we kick off, I gotta do the plug. This podcast is supported by listeners like you at Substack. For $5 per month or $50 per year at shtpost.substack.com, you can help what we're doing here and receive access to occasional newsletters and bonus audio content. And now that that's out of the way, let's get right into it. We've got a lot of stuff to get through on this episode, so sit back, relax, and let's do it. Last week, it was finally upon us. Storm Area 51, they can't stop us all, that Facebook event from episodes prior and internet infamy at this point, happened. It was scheduled for Friday, September 20th at 3 a.m. local time, from what we could see from live feeds and Twitter. Some people did assemble at the opening to Area 51. But for every participant in the event, there was a equal, if not greater than, reaction from law enforcement and military. For those who don't remember entirely, the Storm Area 51 meme took off after a Facebook event page sort of blew up. The ask was that they will meet up in rural Nevada and coordinate parties. Quote, "If we Naruto run, we can move faster than their bullets. Let's see them aliens," the event page said. 21-year-old Maddie Roberts was the person who made that Facebook event, and he maintains that it was purely a joke. It went viral in July. There were memes about aliens moving into people's homes, about, you know, going into Area 51 and trying to leave with items like a bad Drake track or, help me out. Or government secrets, or alien boyfriends and girlfriends. The military responded at the time, warning essentially, if you try to storm Area 51, the military will do what the military does to prevent any sort of breach of security, would be, I guess, the way that they would put that. Well, it came and went without a splash. There was a video of some guy Naruto running behind a local news anchor that was quite funny. But otherwise, the event was about what was expected. Some people would show up, some YouTubers filmed some spots, but it doesn't appear that anybody actually got into Area 51. We didn't see them aliens. And, you know, until next time. We gotta be a little bit more sly about it next time we try this. In a piece of news that will be pertinent to Shitpost listeners, the DHS has finally, you know, got real with itself and come to terms with the fact that online hate drives domestic terrorism in the United States. Last week on Friday, the Department of Homeland Security called violent white supremacism one of the most potent forces driving a surge of mass shootings in the United States. It also acknowledged the role of online conspiracy theories, social media, and extremist websites in fomenting domestic terror, the Daily Beast reports. DHS's 37-page counterterrorism strategy that was released on Friday said this: similar to how ISIS inspired and connected with potential radical Islamist terrorists, white supremacist violent extremists connect with like-minded individuals online. In addition to mainstream social media platforms, white supremacist violent extremists use lesser-known sites like Gab, 8chan, and NChan, as well as encrypted channels. Celebration of violence and conspiracy theories about the ethnic replacement of whites are prominent in their online circles. This is a relatively new approach for DHS. Since 2009, the department has been turning away from right-wing extremism. After a internal DHS analysis on the subject leaked in conservative media and set off a political firestorm. But in recent years, as right-wing extremist violence has become harder to ignore under the Trump era, and we have, you know, a steady increase in white supremacist and, you know, right-wing extremist killings, there's been increased pressure on DHS to take action on this. The Trump administration has mostly been resistant to these actions, urging DHS to stay focused on border security and radical Islam. But at some point, it is just impossible to ignore. The DHS acknowledged this on Friday, that low and domestic terrorists have caused more deaths in the United States in recent years than foreign groups had. On August 3rd, the department finally stepped in after the mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, at the hands of a white supremacist, took 22 lives. Last week, the DOJ announced that they had arrested white supremacist troll, best known as Jack Corbin. Jack Corbin's real name is Daniel McMahon. He's 31 years old, and he lives with his parents in Florida. On Gab and other social media, McMahon fantasizes about violence, fantasizes about rape, and often targets women, people of color, religious minorities for his hate. I wrote a piece last year for Right Wing Watch. We were able to sort of follow up on the work of anti-fascist activist and researchers who believed they had identified Corbin. We were able to come in and hit the nail on the head and just get it down rock solid that this was exactly who he was. And yeah, he's going to be in jail now for a while. So I'm having on Molly Conger. She's on Twitter at Socialist Dog Mom. She's a fantastic community reporter in Charlottesville, and she was often the target of some of Daniel McMahon's most vile, disgusting shit, to, you know, not use any euphemisms there. So we're going to talk to Molly about what Jack Corbin's arrest signals, about what it means, and just what, like, how much did it take for us to get to this point and sort of all the damage he's done and the alliances he has. So enjoy this interview with Molly Conger. All right, joining Shitpost now to help me talk about the arrest of a white supremacist troll known online as Jack Corbin, but known in real life as Daniel McMahon, we have Molly Conger. Molly, what's up, man?
Hey. Hey, how's it going?
Sorry, it's habit. Daniel McMahon, what a character. I remember we talked last year a little bit while I was reporting out, really trying to staple down some research and, reporting that some anti-fascist activists had done before me, and just to get it, like, rock solid confirmed. I was able to do it, and I did not expect that last week we would find out that he had been picked up by feds, because it seemed like there was a lot of shit he could have been picked up for, but, it turns out that threatening a political candidate is what did it. You have been on the receiving end of some of the nastiest shit that he's put out there. So what was your reaction to his arrest?
I mean, it was about time, right? Like you said, right. He's been doing this for a very long time. As a prison abolitionist, it's hard to be super excited when someone goes to jail. I mean, it's not, we all know that jail is not going to fix him. He's not going to be rehabilitated in prison. That's not really a possibility for Daniel. But at the same time, he's been out of control for a long time, and I've been worried for at least a year now that he was going to take it offline, that he was going to hurt someone, and that, you know, posting back and forth and taking the harassment and posting about him, like, it wasn't going to stop him. This was the only thing that was going to make him stop. And what he was doing was dangerous. You know, there's no evidence he ever left his mom's house in Florida. You know, he would talk about going places. He would post pictures that I'm pretty sure other people took for him of him, of street corners in North Carolina. And he claimed he moved to Asheville. I don't think he ever left Florida, but you don't have to leave your house to cause harm. I mean, he was inciting violence against a lot of people in a lot of places.
Yeah. And that's something the people I spoke with for that piece I did last year, whether it's, you, Emily Gorkinski, various other activists who have been threatened by him, voiced to me, which is, you know, we're not sure how much of a potential he was himself to go commit an act of violence, but he certainly, through his interactions on Gab with people who had committed acts of violence and his interactions with people in the white supremacist movement that really glorify and fantasize violence, that he has the potential, not just him as this like almost cartoonish caricature of a violent white supremacist, but inspiring others to go act and posing a greater risk than himself entirely. So since his arrest, you've been following sort of the developments of this a little bit more closely than I have. My mom was in town this weekend, so I was trying to stay offline and not up to date. But what's happened since his arrest?
So he had a detention hearing today down at the federal court in the Middle District of Florida, so in Tampa, and the magistrate judge denied bond. His lawyer filed a motion last night asking for bond, saying that, you know, he was totally willing to give up his guns and his passport and get a mental health evaluation, and his dad was going to sign a $50,000 property bond. And the judge, you know, looked at the evidence, and I didn't go to the hearing. I wish I could have made it, but it was not justifiable to make it down to Tampa for a 20-minute hearing. But right. The judge looked at the evidence to him and said he's mentally unstable. He's glorifying mass shooters. He's cheerleading this violence. These are red flags. No bond. So he is still detained down in Tampa for now. I suspect in the coming weeks he'll be moved up here. The charges are in the Western District of Virginia. So he'll be moved up here and arraigned up here. I suspect he'll enter a not guilty plea. I can't imagine someone like Jack admitting they did anything wrong. You know, his lawyer argued today that what he said was free speech. It was just political speech. And we hear that a lot. You know, it's,
yeah.
You know, you may not like it, but it's free speech. It's not free speech to intimidate someone out of running for office. And so that's the interesting thing about these charges, is it's not harassment. It's not, you know, just making threats. The specific nature of the charges are that he used racial intimidation to interfere with an election. He caused a black man to drop out of an election because of these threats. So that's a specific kind of crime. It's a felony that carries a 5-year sentence. So it's a little bit more serious in nature in terms of the crime being charged than the kind of harassment that he should have been charged with numerous times over the past 2 years.
Yeah, and almost in a way, it's like he is going to be subject to potentially a more severe penalty than he would have for the, you know, I'm no lawyer, but am I, you know, layman's interpretation, what looked like clear violations of laws against harassment, against racial intimidation and whatnot, that, you know, it's certainly a lot more serious for him now. In a way, he's like almost, I don't want to downplay it, but to borrow their terms, like shitposting his way into a prison.
We've seen some changes in just in recent weeks in terms of people fed posting their way into prison. But Jack's case is unique in that he wasn't talking about doing mass shootings of his own. He wasn't talking about building bombs. He wasn't inciting that kind of specific terroristic violence that a lot of these other guys have got themselves arrested for. It's truly a feat to have just shitposted your way into prison this way. It's incredible. But he's an interesting character because he locked his account sometime last year. So his account on Gab was, you had to have a Gab account and follow him to see his posts. He had 2,000 followers. That's really not a lot. I mean, by Gab standards, it's a pretty big account because Gab's kind of a ghost town, but that's not a lot of followers, all things considered, in terms of social media in general. But he was connected to a lot of different kinds of people. You know, it's like a middle school cafeteria on the white nationalist world. You know, there's neo-Confederates and neo-Nazis, and there's, you know, regular red pill, and there's siege-pilled guys, and there's, you know, these different kinds of racists. But Jack was connected to a lot of different kinds of racists, and he was connected to a lot of people whose names you probably know, you know, who's connected to Hunter Wallace, whose real name is Brad Griffin, the PR chief for League of the South, who's connected to Cantwell for a long time. Cantwell, you know, talked about how he tried to hire Jack, but he didn't have the money to do it. So they were pretty close for a while. They shared a lot of intel. He's connected to White Boner, the David Brennan, the guy who had all those conspiracy theories about James Fields. He's connected to Robert Bowers, the Tree of Life synagogue shooter. But one story that I've not seen written that I think is pretty interesting is how connected he was to Patrick Howley. He was at
Big League Politics. So Patrick Howley, I think he's moved on from Big League Politics now, but he's a very, I don't need to be polite. He's a maniac. He's a fucking, he's a fucking nutcase.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And that's, I think, one of the ways in which Jack was dangerous that we don't really talk about enough is that he was feeding a lot of this sort of violent Nazi propaganda into, I mean, I wouldn't call Big League Politics mainstream media, but it is a conduit to reasonably mainstream right-wing media. And he would feed these stories to Patrick Howley about activists in North Carolina that would make it into the news. This harassment of Dwayne Dixon, that came from Jack.
And Big League Politics is also, like, most notably, the Ralph Northam blackface yearbook photo. That came from Big League Politics. So the fact that this guy who is now facing federal prison for being this disgusting piece of shit white supremacist was a source of information for, again, it's not a Breitbart or anything, but something that is like one step removed. Although Breitbart's really its own story. That could be a whole nother podcast. But
but like you said, they broke the Northam blackface story. So stories from Big League were making it into the mainstream news. And Big League was publishing stories for which the only source was Jack's Gab posts. They published a story about Don Gathers, the man that he harassed out of running for office. And last I checked, it was still up. And the only source for that story was Jack.
Damn, so I love to do journalism.
I'm confused as to how Patrick Howley isn't facing the same charges, because he gave that story a much larger audience.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point.
I mean, it could just be that the feds didn't piece it together because, you know, they're not really that good at their jobs.
Yeah, not always. No.
I mean, Jack could have been picked up 1,000 times before this. And that's sort of disappointing to me and to many of Jack's other victims, is that no one took us seriously. That we've been talking about how this man was inciting violence against us, cyber-stalking us. I mean, I just today went back through several thousand screenshots that I have. And for the last year and a half, every time I leave town, he notifies everyone on Gab where I am and what I'm doing. So he's cyber-stalking me. He's telling people where to find me. Sometimes specific locations and specific times. Like, he's trying to get us killed. And I don't think there's a debate about that. And people weren't taking that seriously. I think, like you said, because he's kind of cartoonish, because he has these, like, strange speech patterns and bizarre fixations. Like, he's really fixated on these, really detailed sexual fantasies that involve poop. Like, it's funny. Sometimes it is funny.
Yeah, I remember the Jack Corbin post where he said he was, like, too racist to eat chocolate ice cream. That that burns in my brain.
Yeah, he's a vanilla man.
But yeah, he is, like, so cartoonish, and it is frustrating that this wasn't really taken seriously until it sort of touched elected office. And I think that can, to some degree, speak to the priorities of federal officials when they're looking at figures like this and cases like this, where, you know, if it's just your average run-of-the-mill person or somebody that they would consider an activist, or, you know, it doesn't seem to be as important to them. Do you think I'm out of line saying that?
No, it's true. It's absolutely true. And I think, too, in terms of ability to prosecute, this is a little bit more clear cut, because it is such a specific law, and there's sort of an A and a B and a C here. Like, he said these things, Don dropped out of the race pretty much right after those posts came to light. I don't know if other people sent them to Don, but I showed them to Don within a day of seeing them. But the screenshots I have of those posts show that I took them within hours of them going up. Don rescinded his announcement very quickly thereafter, so that the cause and effect here is pretty clear. And so in terms of being able to prosecute this, I could see this being much more straightforward than harassment, which, you know, is more of a gray area. It's about, you know, emotional impact and things like that.
Ayana, is there anything about the story of Daniel McMahon that you think is important for people who are maybe just hearing this name for the first time should understand about him?
So I first started paying attention to Daniel late 2017 because he was passing off as his own work this list that had been circulating on the Chans of the number changes every time you talk about it. Sometimes it's 500, sometimes it's 700, 800, somewhere between 500 and 900 names of people that were at Unite the Right on the counter-protest side. And he was passing this off as his own work, and he was sort of the primary spreader of this list. And so, you know, he calls himself Antifa Hunter, and all the other Nazis, mm-hmm. you know, think he's some kind of master doxer. That list, first of all, again, not his work. Second of all, it is an exported RSVP list from a Facebook event. That list has names of regular-ass people who are not anti-fascists, who are not, some of them aren't even political. It's just regular-ass people who RSVP'd to a Facebook event for August 12th, 2017. So that list circulating, from Jack to these people he's connected to, puts in the line of fire a lot of just normal fucking people who live in my town. I mean, that list had, Cree Deeds and Tom Perriello, who are, local Democratic politicians on it. Like, it was just regular people who were out that day. And so he's been spreading that list around and uses their names a lot. And he's got this reputation as a master doxer. In my 2 years of following Jack's work and spending a lot of time reading all of his posts, I can't think of a single time when he personally did the research, did the real legwork, the groundwork required to say that you did a dox. He published people's names a lot. So I don't want to make it the impact of what he did. He published a lot of people's names and information that he got from news sources. Like, anytime people got arrested at a rally, he would post their mugshots and their pictures and sometimes their, personal contact information. But he did not successfully perform even a single dox. And I want to make sure he doesn't get credit for that.
Yeah.
He's not good at what he did. He's not good. I don't want to idiot shame, but the man's an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, really just top to bottom sucks. But yeah, now he is looking at some potential consequences for his actions. I'm like you. I do not like the idea of the police in general or sending people to prison. But if it's got to happen to somebody, this guy seems like a decent candidate. So,
we're not abolishing prison this year. So I think while we work towards building the kind of society that doesn't have prisons, people like Jack need to be inside of them. And so the day the walls come down, we will be living in a different kind of society that's not creating more people like him.
Yeah, hopefully.
But we can't do that work if people like Jack are threatening to rape us to death every day. That work cannot be done with people like Jack out here.
Right, exactly.
I want to say one last thing, that this pattern that Jack had of harassing and attacking women specifically, we can't ignore that. We cannot ignore that. I don't want this to get lost in the story. And it's not to downgrade, what he did to Don, which is what he's been charged with. But this is a pattern over and over and over and over again, that by the time these guys step really all the way over the line, by the time they do something that gets somebody hurt or gets them arrested, they've already hurt women. So when you see this, you see this pattern of behavior of attacking women relentlessly, this violent misogyny. Don't wait for him to do something that you think is more interesting or more worthy of a story, or that you think might land him in federal prison. When you see this, take note of it and cover it. Because Jack, if public pressure had been applied sooner on Jack's behavior, he very well could have been charged a year ago. We could have avoided all of this. And like I said, he's heavily connected within the movement. Jason Kessler's new lawsuit against the city of Charlottesville was written by Jack Corbin. He wrote that lawsuit, and they've both publicly said that.
Right.
So the work that he's doing is causing very real harm in my community specifically, and in Chapel Hill, and really everywhere. But my work is here, and I can see the harm that it's doing to my community. And I just wish that it had been news before the feds made it news, because we had this information all along.
Right. So I've been talking with Molly Conger. This arrest was, I don't know, it made my week last week to think that, one more of these guys is in a position where he can't cause the harm and danger that he did. But I know it seemed like you shared a similar feeling. But because this is Shitpost, I have one more question for you before you go. What is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
I just turned 30, so I am a senior citizen online, so I don't understand TikTok. I don't know how to access it myself. I don't understand it, but every now and again, somebody will helpfully, for seniors like me, put some cool TikTok videos in a thread on Twitter, and I recently saw a thread of Amish TikTok videos, and you may be saying to yourself, that's not possible, Molly. Au contraire. They use 12-volt batteries to charge their cell phones, which technically God is mad about, I guess. And so I saw a bunch of Amish TikTok videos, including one of just a young Amish woman driving a horse-drawn carriage set to Old Town Road, and I highly recommend it.
Oh my goodness. I am going to have to check that out for sure. This strikes multiple chords of interest for me. All right, we've been joined by Molly Conger. You can follow her on Twitter at @socialistdogmom. Molly, thanks so much for coming on Shitpost, and we'll have to have you on again soon.
At least after Danny's trial.
Yeah, at the very least.
Thanks, Jared. Head is mad at black, got the boots black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch. Now, can't nobody tell me nothing.
Karen Pence, best known in the American discourse as the wife of Vice President Mike Pence, created a Twitter account last month and over the weekend really brought it to life. She shared a video announcing her intentions are to use that Twitter account to help the 2020 campaign.
Karen Pence here. You know me as the Second Lady of the United States, but there are probably a lot of things that you don't know about me. For example, I enjoy painting, I love to ride my bike, and I like nothing better than reading a good book. On my new Twitter account, I will share with you what I'm up to when I'm not in my office at the White House. I'm looking forward to being on the campaign trail to help tell the story of what President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence are accomplishing in the Trump administration. Today, we have more jobs, more growth, and a stronger and safer America. And now is not the time to stop the momentum. We are just getting started. So follow along and find out why we need to keep America great.
So Karen Pence has, you know, announced she's going to use this account to help tell the story of Trump and Pence and what they're accomplishing in the Trump administration. It's really quite striking because Karen Pence was no fan of Trump during the campaign, you know, and it really is just sort of like the coming together of what we've seen happen in GOP politics so far, and this is just like an online expression of it. You have all of these Republicans that we were supposed to believe are principled on small governments and, you know, moral character and a strong family, really just flipping over and frying like, you know, a cracked egg on a hot skillet. And that hot skillet is Trumpism. It's great. An egg analogy. Yeah, she was immediately like ratioed and exploded for this video and tweet, has since just taken to tweeting the family animals and some mundane stuff. But yeah, Karen Pence is now online. Axios learned last week that conservative leaders are circulating data to White House staff. That data claims that adults who vape will turn on President Trump if Trump follows through on his planned ban on flavored e-cigarettes. Paul Blair, the director of strategic initiatives at Americans for Tax Reform, told Axios, "While parents may be concerned about e-cigarettes, the people who genuinely care about vaping as a voting issue so far outweighs the number of people Trump needs to win in 2020 that they are royally screwing themselves by doing this. And I never thought I would see this or say this, but there appears to be a at least somewhat tangible vaping voting block that it almost sounds like a joke, but it does seem that it is giving some of these folks a scare. The announcement of this vape ban, which would ban, I guess, presumably like flavored Juul pods and stuff, is not being received well. It's one of those bipartisan, what's the meme of like the two hands coming to shake together. Like, I feel like a lot of people are not a fan of this. And it's the same bullshit argument we've seen over and over again about how it's getting the kids involved and everything. Adult vapers want their flavors. You know, what can we say, folks? And it, 2020, you know, if Biden hasn't completely just like fallen asleep on the debate stage or accidentally said a racial slur or something, then, you know, maybe the vape, it'll be the vape vote 2020. I saw this piece from Osita Wanavu in the New Republic, and I thought it was very pertinent to something that we've been hearing so much about in online discourse, which is cancel culture. You either don't think it's real, you either think it's real, you either participate in it, maybe you don't think you participate in it. And if you're conservative, you really are rallying around it as this like big sort of Goliath to fight, this social byproduct of the complete breakdown of the SJWs. But Osita has a very thought-provoking piece, and I wanted to have him on to sort of elaborate on what he wrote about cancel culture. So joining us now, we have Osita Wanavu. Enjoy. So, Osita, before we start this conversation, let's get on common ground first. When we're talking about cancel culture, what are we talking about specifically?
Well, that's one of the things I actually try to unpack in this piece, because I don't think people are very consistent in their definitions. People talk about all kinds of things being canceled. One of the pieces that I reference in the article is a piece from Digiday where they say that Louis C.K. has been canceled. I think that most people familiar with the discourse would agree with that. But they also go ahead and say that things like guacamole has been canceled, things like In-N-Out's French fries have been canceled. There's this very expansive use of the word canceled that I think one has to conclude is just basically referring to the act of criticizing people on the internet. People lump all kinds of people, all kinds of entities into the conversation about what things people on social media dislike and want to cancel. And that's one of the things I think that was important for me to sort of get at in the piece, the extent to which this has become a kind of catch-all phrase that encompasses all kinds of criticism from all kinds of people, large groups of people, small groups of people, criticism for all kinds of reasons. It's just become this unwieldy, amorphous descriptor in our culture. And that's one of the things that I wrote this piece to try to hack away at.
Yeah, because if we're working under this definition of, you know, guacamole being canceled, for the love of God, I mean, what hasn't been canceled to some degree at this point? And you sort of, you open up the piece with the 1964 case of Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce was arrested in a sting for violating obscenity laws for saying the word cocksucker. This is not something we would think that people would go to jail for now, but at the time, he did. And at the end of the day, Lenny Bruce, you know, was sentenced, he was on appeal, and ultimately overdosed from morphine. And one of the things that you included in your piece is that, you know, I forget if it was a prosecutor or a commentator at the time, was mm-hmm. just saying that, you know, essentially they used the law to, in a way, and I don't want to make light of it here, but mm-hmm. essentially, like, canceled him to death.
Yeah.
And like, that is one extreme standard. But on the other hand, you have more modern examples that are much less extreme. So
right.
In the piece, you bring up a couple examples of, you know, Dave Chappelle, Shane Gillis, you know, prominent writers. Like New York Times op-ed page. I don't know if you said that, but that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what Lenny Bruce went through was extremely severe. And there seems to be this common cause around people like Dave Chappelle and Shane Gillis, at least in right-wing conservative circles. And they kind of liken it to the plight of like a Lenny Bruce and whatnot. But in your piece, at least the takeaway I had from it was that is not the same thing, and it's almost insulting to sort of compare the two. Can you sort of explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I start with Bruce just to establish a comparison, right? You have all of these kinds of very broad claims about what it means for somebody to be canceled on social media, and these kinds of wild comparisons that get drawn up by people like David Brooks, people who complain on Twitter about Twitter criticisms. Well, they'll say, you know, the impulse here is something like the impulses that led to people being sent to the gulag, or similar to the impulses that animated the struggle sessions under Mao, and all kinds of like wild and crazy stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I most recently remember Bret Stephens, that whole episode from a few weeks ago,
when he came out
and he's like, this is what Joseph Goebbels did.
Exactly. People say this kind of thing all the time. And my thinking was, okay, if you use those kinds of comparisons, what then do you say about what American life was like within living memory? Just a couple of decades ago, you don't have to go back as far as Bruce, but I just did because this was a piece that was motivated by controversies within stand-up comedy. But if you use those kinds of broad, terrifying comparisons, what then do you say about a period of American society, which there's still people old enough to remember, in which censorship was not just a kind of metaphor or something you could extrapolate as a potential consequence down the line if things go a certain way in society. It was actually happening. It was happening all the time. It was happening to people like Bruce. It was happening to people much less famous than Bruce. It was happening to ordinary people, not just censorship as far as obscenity goals go, but in terms of social ostracism, the kinds of things that you can and cannot say within a community. There was a tweet that I actually saw on my way out of work today that was completely unrelated to this, but I thought, you know, reflected something that I was trying to get at. Somebody tweeted something like, you know, it would be great if we returned to the dating atmosphere of the 1950s, you know, the sock hops and the drive-in theaters, and wouldn't that be romantic and lovely? And somebody quote-tweeted this, I think it was Jabuki White, who was a writer at The Daily Show, saying, yeah, it'd be really cool if we went back to the time when if you were a gay person and you were caught with another gay person, you'd be lobotomized and, like, sent out of your community.
Yeah, yeah, there's this nostalgia for an era that, like, I don't think they really want. Or maybe they do, and maybe that's the problem.
I don't know what time people would be willing to argue straightforwardly, would be better for free expression and better for people who are on the margins of society than today. That's not to say that there are not extreme situations and populations that are truly, genuinely being hurt by social ostracism in a way that it extends beyond metaphor. I mentioned one of them at the end of the piece. There's been a wave of transgender violence this year. It's happening all the time, frankly. 19 people so far have been killed. If you really, really do care about social ostracism and you care about intolerance, I think these are the kinds of things that you should probably be focusing on rather than the phenomenon of people being mad at Dave Chappelle on Twitter. I think that we have an unbalanced conversation that is driven, I think, by anxieties that people aren't willing to admit straightforwardly. And those anxieties underlie claims about contemporary society that don't really hold up to historical scrutiny, don't really hold up to common sense, and they don't hold up to the facts of the case that people will often bring up as examples of how terrible cancel culture is. I go through a number of them in the piece, and there are others I could have mentioned. In fact, after the piece went up and was published, people, you know, reached out to me on social media saying, well, you know, what about this in this case that you could have mentioned as an example of cancel culture really screwing somebody over? And it's just amusing to me the number of these cases in which if you dig down 1 centimeter below the surface,
yeah,
you will find that things are not what people have claimed them to be. You'll find that things aren't as bad as people claim them to be. So one example that was brought up today was Justine Sacco. I don't know if you remember her case, but a couple of years ago, this was a comms person who was on her way to Africa.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Made this
yeah.
tweet about AIDS and being white people found very offensive. I think she then took off. And by the time she landed, people had turned this into a viral thing. She was fired afterwards. And this is one of the cases to me. It's saying, isn't this an example of cancel culture taking on somebody who isn't really famous, who isn't really that powerful, and completely destroying their lives? And I was like, okay, well, I'll think about that and sort of see if I can find out what did happen to Justine Sacco. I hadn't heard that name in a long time. Turns out that as recently as last year, at least the last time anybody wrote about her that I could find, Justine Sacco was hired to oversee corporate communications for Match, that complex of companies that includes Tinder, Match.com, OkCupid. This is actually a company that is owned mostly by the company she was originally fired from. So this is kind of return for her back to this place where she lost her job. Before that, she was running comms, I think, for FanDuel. So this is not an example that I would sort of bring up as somebody whose life has been completely destroyed by public criticism. I think that what you have here is a situation in which somebody did something bad, there are consequences, and after some time, she's back at it. I don't think that people wanted her life to be destroyed. I think that's the case in most of these situations. I think that people just sort of voice criticisms. They don't necessarily want to see people lose their, get out on the street for saying something intemperate. But you have this sort of discourse that implies that anybody who offers strong criticisms of a columnist or comedian or even an ordinary person is somebody who is just out to destroy as many lives as they can just for the hell of it, and it's purely cynical exercise and blah, blah, blah. I don't know that that's really borne out by the actual facts of how these cases usually turn out. There's one example that I mentioned in the piece of a young adult novel author, one of several that's been mentioned in all kinds of pieces over the past few years about how toxic YA Twitter supposedly is and how destructive it supposedly is. But this is the person who received a lot of criticism online for a book of hers and the way that it handled race. She issued an apology to the YA book community. And this apology was well received by people who had criticized her. They said, this is what we wanted. We wanted engagement. We didn't want this person to never write again or for the book to be pulled necessarily. We just wanted somebody to acknowledge these criticisms that we felt strongly about. That book is actually going to come out in November. I think that there were some changes that were made, to the book. But this is how culture works, right? This is how society works, especially in this age. You have mediums, platforms that allow more of a direct connection to people who create, or even just other ordinary people. You have this bridge that didn't exist before, where criticism can be leveled.
Yeah, that's something you mentioned in the piece, where it's like, there is like cancel culture, whatever you want to define it as. If we are going to define it as sort of people getting mad online, people getting mad on Twitter, what that is the consequence of a world where we have more free speech at ready access to the average person than we ever have before. And I think that's like a dead on, super important point to make.
Right. And I think it's important to say, I think that there are cases in which people do undergo or experience harassment. I think that there are places in which online social justice activism can get overzealous, as I mentioned in a piece. But none of these things are novel. None of these things are new phenomena in society. None of these things, I think, are worse than what it would have meant to be on the other side of public opinion a couple of decades ago. I think that people have been criticized by strangers and have seen themselves maybe get more famous than they might have anticipated. And this is stuff that's happened for a long time now. This is something that is sort of inherent to a kind of mass media, mass culture society. This wasn't invented in 2014. It's not a product of Twitter. These are just things that we've all been working through for some time now. But if you're going to make the claim beyond the fact that maybe we should make sure we're not harassing people and maybe we should be mindful of how things can blow up and get viral before people are ready for it, if you're moving beyond those things, which I think are sensible things to say, if you're moving beyond just sort of basic critiques of cyberbullying into this hysterical notion that because YA book authors have been criticized on Twitter over the past couple of years, we're now entering into a Fahrenheit 451 kind of scenario where books are going to be burned and things aren't going to be published. To remove from standard critiques of people being mean online and just saying, you know, people should be less mean, to saying the fact that people criticize Dave Chappelle is evidence that we're now in a kind of McCarthy era. These are insane things to say. Yeah. These are outrageous things to say.
Right, and it always strikes me as, like, you're not trying to get free of some, like, cancel culture boogeyman. It's like, how it always strikes me is that what they really want the freedom from or the protection from is not cancel culture. It's criticism.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. And one of the other things that I think is worth responding to as well, because I've spent a lot of the day just sort of hearing people out and going back and forth with people who read the piece and had thoughts about it. This idea that about ordinary people being particularly susceptible to online mob dynamics, or what would get called mob dynamics on the internet. This idea that my piece wasn't sensitive enough to that concern. I think it's interesting that the same people who raise this objection are the very same people, as I'm sure you cover, as somebody who writes about right-wing media and people and writes about culture war stuff. These are the very same people who will look at a college op-ed writer or some random activist on some campus somewhere and then blow what they've done or what they've said into a kind of national phenomenon, into a kind of evidence of some kind of national crisis. These are people who have had trouble criticizing individual college students for the things that they've said or the things that they believe over the past few years.
On the right, there's a whole industry for it. There's a dedicated organization. Turning Point USA was predicated on the fact that, like, because, like, something happened at a college or one professor said something to a student, that there is a crisis on campus. And what is it? I always mix them up. The Liberty Institute, I believe, has Campus Reform, which is a news site entirely dedicated just to, like, pumping out these clips of college kids who are presumably anywhere from 18 to 21 years old, who certainly aren't asking for fame, and trying to blow them up and get them on Fox News and stuff.
Right. So, I mean, you know, and I think that people, let's be clear, I think people have the right to write about whatever they want, to criticize whatever people want, ordinary, famous or not. I think that's entirely within your rights as a journalist. If that's what you care about, you do you. But if you have spent the past several years looking for every, you know, liberal arts college student who has ideas about cultural appropriation and bring those columns to national attention, don't turn around now and say that you care about online mob dynamics, or you care about people with no power being criticized online. You don't at all. These people are often people who have made careers blowing these kinds of individual people or these small groups of activists into evidence of crisis, into sort of morality tales. They have every right to do that. I think that this is, again, just an age where we have to expect that ordinary people are going to get caught up in things that are beyond them and wider circles of criticism than they might have in the past. It's just something we have to accept as a society, as connected as we are. But to then pretend that, you know, that your criticisms of cancel culture are rooted in some kind of deep concern about the extent to which ordinary people can get wrapped up in larger things, I think is disingenuous. I think that the actual root is an anxiety about identity politics, an anxiety about the kinds of people who are leveling criticisms, not the fact that they're leveling criticisms. And I think that should be obvious to people who have watched, I think, this particular discourse, this particular set of debates, and the wider sort of political correctness stuff over the past few years.
Yeah, well, I think that is spot on. And, You know, we're just about out of time, but I got to ask, is cancel culture canceled, Osita?
Sadly, I don't think so. You know, I did, one of the reasons why I did this piece is like, I get tired of the takes and counter takes and the sort of circular conversation that we have every time something controversial happens where nothing is ever resolved. And I just wanted to do something that felt, at least to me, authoritative. But, you know, there's no actual antidote to elite media panic. These are things that happen in waves. These kinds of conversations happen in waves. We've been talking about the same set of issues for a long time now, and I don't know that any particular piece or any particular set of arguments is going to dissuade people from getting a bee in their bonnet about all this, but I did what I could.
Yeah, and your piece was very thought-provoking. Like I said, listeners, we will put it in the show notes. I highly urge you go read it over at The New Republic. Osita, thanks again for coming on the show, but because this is Shitpost, I do have one more question to ask you, or my listeners will kill me. What is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
So my favorite thing on the internet right now is actually something from 2 weeks ago. I'm just getting caught up with a lot of reading now. But my favorite thing that I've read recently is Coy Robbins' piece in The New Yorker about Clarence Thomas. He has a new book coming out about Clarence Thomas, where he basically lays out the argument that Clarence Thomas is kind of essentially a black nationalist or a black separatist on the bench of the Supreme Court, who has come to his conservative positions on issues like affirmative action, not because he's a standard conservative of the kind we're all familiar with, the kind we've seen on the bench before, because he's approaching the issue from this kind of separatist angle that is informed by his own personal life. And it's truly fascinating, and it made me really, really excited for the book. And I think the connection we can make to this piece is that I really appreciate anything that gets into identity political conversation from a new angle. I think the conversation can often feel very, very tired, and people feel, you know, I feel like we tread the same ground a lot. But I think that there are things that Robin lays out in this article that are potentially new ways to talk about a very familiar set of issues through examining the life and work of this this man. And yeah, I think everybody should read the piece and look forward to the book as much as I do.
All right. We've been joined by Osita Wanavu. He's a staff writer at The New Republic. We've got that piece in the show notes, and you'll probably see it floating around Twitter somewhere. The con of cancel culture. I hope I'm remembering that correctly. Osita, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on Shitpost, and we'll have to have you on again sometime soon.
Thanks for having me.
Fortnite is killing its own game. Epic Games, the creator of Fortnite, has announced that they will be introducing bots to online multiplayer. The announcement read, "In the next season, we are adding bots to Fortnite. They will behave similarly to normal players and will help provide a better path for players to grow in skill. Bots will work in conjunction with the new matchmaking system, and as your skill improves, you'll face fewer bots. Bots will not be present in competitive playlists. This is another system we will continue to update and iterate." So that sucks. Fortnite is arguably, if not empirically, the most successful game franchise, multiplayer game franchise in a long ass time. And by adding in bots, people didn't seem too excited about this, but it is kind of like, you know, dealing itself the own death blow for what has been a huge cultural phenomena and impact and like reshaped online gaming for what could be forever. This one's really quick, but the payment processor Square has deleted the account used by the white nationalist hate group American Renaissance. Sucks to suck, buddy. And moving on. from The Verge. They reported on Friday that that Facebook had suspended tens of thousands of apps as part of an ongoing investigation into improper data use by third-party developers. The investigation was part of a broader effort that Facebook launched after the Cambridge Analytica data privacy scandal rocked the company. So in what seems to be a positive step, Facebook has acted proactively, I guess, here, and has eliminated many apps that are mishandling user data the same way that Cambridge Analytica was putting out that personality quiz to gather user data and then mishandling that data. So again, positive stuff. The community over at r/TheDonald on Reddit is the mega hub of pro-Trump activity on the internet, but it has been in a hell of a stir lately. It is just, it's nuts in there. It's not happy. There's a lot of infighting happening. And joining us now to help us break down what the hell is going on, we have my friend, Ollie Breland. He's a reporter at Mother Jones. So buckle up. We're going into the Reddit subverse. I'm joined now by Ollie Breland. He's a tech and misinformation reporter for Mother Jones. What's up, man?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I feel like you were a good person to have on the podcast this week because I feel like I've been piggybacking off of your reporting on The Donald, which is the big subreddit for pro-Trump memes, discussion, videos, YouTube shit. How would you characterize The Donald in your own words?
Yeah, The Donald is like a few different things. It's helpful to think of it in some senses as like kind of a really, really important bridge that goes in a lot of different directions. And so like one direction that bridge goes in is that it's a sort of like a pathway for a lot of weird online like right-wing pro-Trump culture to sort of get to mainstream spaces. But then by the same token, it's a way that sort of more mainstream normie people can get radicalized into different sort of more extreme things. And so it has a tremendous reach. It's one of the few sort of centralized hubs of online Donald Trump support. There's like
going to say, because there's like big Twitter accounts and then there's like YouTube channels and stuff, but this is really like the place where it's all in one spot.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's all of those places are sort of controlled by like individual people or groups, but mm-hmm. this is the only place that's sort of like democratized. And so everyone's kind of flocked to it because of that.
Yeah. So you touched on it briefly. I feel like we should flesh out a little bit just how influential The Donald has been in that spillover to sort of mainstream, more conservative, I guess, zeitgeist, if you will. You've got Tom Fitton going Fitton mode, flexing those beast mode selfies on The Donald, of course, but that's silly. But there's also, you know, memes will start on The Donald and then they'll end up on a Twitter account like Jack Posobiec or something. They'll wind up, stuff from The Donald will wind up on Fox News occasionally, or at least sort of, you know, like comments left will leave there. The Trump administration has done AMAs on the Donald Trump subreddit. I mean, how can we really stress like how influential The Donald is in the broader MAGA universe, if you will?
It's like extremely influential, just like you said. And kind of like on that note too, like big heavy hitters have posted memes that have come out of there. People like Dinesh D'Souza.
Hell yeah, baby.
Yeah. Trump himself. Trump invited like a very prolific poster, Carpe Donctum, who I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, like to the White House for an event. Memes end up on like Donald Trump's page. Whether or not they're getting them from the page itself, its reach is so big that if they're not getting them there directly, they're getting them secondhand. Brad Parscale, Trump's campaign director, as of 2016, said that he checked the page every single day. So,
yeah. So that brings us to sort of the next chapter. So here we have it set up already. We've got The Donald, this city on a hill, if you will, this big, beautiful collection of Pepe the Frogs and like whatever MAGA influence was going on. And then something happened in the Pacific Northwest. A bunch of users started threatening to, you know, do violence against police, against public officials. And the Donald went into quarantine on Reddit. We've mentioned it on the show before. I think I've actually read from some of your reporting on the show. But sort of what happened and how has the community reacted?
Yeah, first off, like, shout outs to Alex Kaplan at Media Matters for doing like the really good reporting on and sort of like documenting the violence that they were posting. The Donald being quarantined, which is what happened after that, where Reddit like limited their reach and made sure that like people couldn't interact as much with them and sort of put them on probation. They're at risk for being deleted now. Happened like in part because of that story. But yeah, I mean, that's just like one of a sort of like long list of really nefarious, noxious behavior that, that they've been posting. Like people think of it as like r/TheDonald. It's like just a Donald Trump supporter hangout. But it's not just that. It's like really toxic stuff. And so like there's all these sorts of violence. There's Islamophobia, which people like Media Matters have documented. You guys at Right Wing Watch, like at Mother Jones, we've done the same thing. And like it's really toxic stuff and really dangerous and hateful.
Yeah, so Reddit finally gets the kahunas or whatever to step up and
finally
take action and say, you know what? They didn't ban it. They put it into quarantine. What is a Reddit quarantine for those who don't know?
Yeah, it's like a sort of probationary status that Reddit puts like really toxic subreddits on. And so what it does is it limits the reach within the app. It makes it harder for their stuff to just get out. And like it also puts them on a sort of like watch notice. So people in the Reddit are very concerned and the Donald, and they're trying to make sure that like violent content doesn't show up because they're afraid that generally the next step with this is that the subreddit gets banned.
Yeah, so that has thrown the community and very much so the moderators of the Donald into like a full-fledged fucking meltdown. I don't know how else to put it. They're like, it's almost like they had this little bubble of stuff and they, you know, would try to get on the front page of Reddit. They would try to get a million upvotes on something. And now that they have been like forcibly contained inside themselves, the hive is just like sort of cannibalizing itself. You wrote a story that we talked about on a prior show about how like people, whether it's moderators, whether it's users of the Donald, like they don't really know. There doesn't seem to be a clear backup plan to what happens if it is as they suspect, where Reddit is going to eventually just ban this subreddit. Yeah. What did you see there? What was the tone? Well, vibe check. What were the vibes?
Well, first off, like you said, it would be tremendous if Reddit like conjured up the sort of like guts to do that. That would be like more bravado than they've ever shown. But yeah, I mean, the vibe is that people are stressed out. They're like testing all sorts of different things. There's an unofficial Telegram channel where they're like, oh, damn, this sucks. Like,
yeah, not chill. This isn't gonna work.
There's this website called Vote that they could go to. It's like a Reddit clone. But like no other website is as good as Reddit, and they know that. And so they, for their specific need, and so they have no idea what to do. And maybe they have like some sort of solution in like their secret Discord that they have, but like I don't know if there's a thing that exists that would help them if they don't have Reddit.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's what happened with Gab, too. It's like, here we are. We are going to have the alternative to Twitter. Yeah. You don't have to deal with Twitter. No censorship, no nothing. And then people get over to Gab, and they're like, damn, this sucks. This sucks ass. It's like, they just don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the software. They just can't handle it. Yeah. And the Donald is something like hundreds of thousands of users, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember about how many people are on
it? Yeah, it's like, I want to say it's like 700,000, I think is the number. I could be wrong in that. But yeah, it just sort of like goes back to every single time you try to create tools or art or anything that is not explicitly political, but you do it in an explicitly political way, it's going to be bad and people are not going to want to engage with it. It's the same thing with like movies, like Thank You for Your Service, and like it's just you inject politics, a specific brand of these things, and people are like, this sucks, and you only get a small segment to use it, and but everyone else is like, this is bad.
Yeah, and that's like one of the contingency plans that's being floated around the mod teams now. I reported something out last week where, I mean, this is all like secondhand. None of these moderators would talk to me. Huge fucking surprise right there. But it looks like, from at least a couple people's accounts, that some of the moderators are thinking about trying to build their own website or forum, or maybe just getting the groundwork done to move the community somewhere else. And then there was a group of moderators that are like, no, we need to work with Reddit. This was all a big misunderstanding. We can work it out, baby. We don't have to do this. But what I'm asking is, what team are you on? Should the Donalds stick around and try to work with the mods, or should they just get out of town?
So, like, professionally, I have no real opinions, but, like, just as a personal observer, I would love to see an extra website that they do on their own just to watch, like, the absolute chaos ensue. It would be hilarious to watch them scramble to deal with the infrastructure of, like, managing a website that would be hopelessly failing because, like, they wouldn't get all of the user base over, and then, like, if there are like violent, toxic people that are on the platform, they'd have to deal with like government warrants, and they would realize that this costs a lot of money, and they might have to do the advertising that they said that they wouldn't to raise money for it. People would get pissed off.
Yeah, people would be like, you're just doing this for money.
Yes. Like 8chan now has seen an uptick, I think, in like FBI requesting information from them and groups like that, and like the Donald would be ripe for things like that if you have people saying insane things on it and then going off and doing violent things, which like there's not a non-zero chance that happens based off the track record of these kinds of people.
Yeah, it's not nuts, but I mean, one thing we can count on for sure is that like whatever happens next, I know I'm going to be keeping a close eye on it, because it's just like this thing that's been the bane of my existence is like fighting with itself right now. And it's like trashy reality TV where you're like, oh, that's garbage. You don't want to deal with that. And then like the drama goes down and you're like, hey, can you turn that up for real quick? I need to hear what's going on. I'm not going to ask you to like look into a crystal ball and try to predict the future, but is there any sort of like precedent that Donald is working off of? Do you know of any online communities that have gone through similar things and where maybe they wound up?
Yeah, so I talked to a researcher kind of about like an adjacent-ish topic on like just how hateful communities like move around like on Reddit, especially like what happens in the wake of their bans. Rishab Nithyanand, and like his sort of the way he explained it was they just kind of moved to different ones. Mm-hmm. But the Donald is unique in that I'm not really sure where a lot of those users would go, especially with how many communities have been banned now. In the past, like people who have been banned from places like Coontown and Million Dollar Stream, which are just virulently toxic subreddits, like it just went to places like Kotaku and Action and things like that. But the Donald has like a lot of just kind of like toxic normies, so like I don't know if they want to hang out in those kinds of spaces. So it just, I don't know, like I don't know what would happen, and it'd be really interesting and bizarre to watch, but it would make it would be a huge blow to the community, though. It'd make them a lot weaker.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine like it's u/ MAGAPED2020 trying to go into like the motorcycle repair community and be like, what's up, my fellow peds?
Maybe they'll go to 4chan? I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. What I think about a lot is when 8chan shut down, yeah, and all the 8chan people started to go back to 4chan, and all the 4chan people, at least from what I saw from a day or two, were just like, get the fuck out of here. We don't want this bullshit. You guys are like getting deplatformed. You're getting the feds involved. Like, Please do not bring that here. Yeah. We're just trying to be racist in peace. Like, it's terrible.
Like, chill, light racism.
Yeah.
They're not like full on like blackpilled like the 8chan folks.
It's like, listen, we're like racist and stuff, but mods will ban us if we say that explicitly we're going to kill somebody.
Yep.
Oh God, that is so depressing. Well, Ollie, is there anything else you think we should know about the Donald that I didn't touch on already?
I mean, it's really powerful, and like, yeah, I don't know if this sort of deplatforming does end up happening, which like I would be truly honestly surprised given how much cover Reddit has given them. Like, by their own measure, again, the researchers I've talked to have also said this too, like, it has violated all of Reddit's rules, not all, but like a lot of their rules, and like it should be banned. So it would be crazy if they did it. It would be a tremendous display of just like Reddit trying to be vaguely consistent for the first time in like a long time.
There's really no excuse. I mean, the way Reddit works, from the way I understand it, like, there's different philosophies and idea of moderation online, and Reddit sort of like picks up some of the blame that would normally fall on itself, like Twitter does. If something's on Twitter that shouldn't be on Twitter, everybody says Twitter, what's going on. But the way Reddit does, with splitting into different boards and subforums and communities, it places the onus first on the moderators of that community. And then when the moderators fail is when Reddit steps in to take administrative action. And by all accounts, at least in my opinion, it feels obvious the moderators of the Donald have not just failed, but miserably failed.
Yeah.
And Reddit, like you said, has cut them so much slack that it hasn't cut other communities before. But if they do get banned, I can already see the Breitbart headlines. I can see Brad Parscale being like, where are my memes, good Reddit sir? But
yeah, he gets like touted as like an expert.
That's bullshit, man.
I'm sure he's good, but then like he also like does stuff like he was touting Parler. I went to Parler. The UI is just like bad. I don't know what anyone is doing like enjoying that website. Like, I don't.
It doesn't seem enjoyable. I mean, it's exactly what you said, and I hadn't thought of it like that before. But you're exactly right. When you like make the product specifically to be political, it just sucks. It's not good. Like, Facebook is, or not Facebook, because Facebook isn't good, but like Twitter is good sometimes. But you can do like anything on Twitter. You get your sports, you get whatever, and then you do some politics on the side. But if it's like, all right, I'm making, so it's like Twitter, but it's just for politics, and also it's like only conservatives talking to each other. It's just not appealing.
Even if it was like conservatives talking about other things, like, no one would like that. Like, you just have people like talking about how good the Patriots are, I guess. Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna get a lot of hate for that.
It's just all
you
all,
don't delete that.
Like, it's just the Bob Kraft fan club just ripping Parler apart.
Yeah, like the only NFL discussions would just be about how Kaepernick needs to like stand the fuck up, which like that would get really boring, but
oh, outstandingly. All right, I've been here with Ollie Breland. He's a, what we say, technology and misinformation reporter at Mother Jones. Yeah, yeah, good. That works.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We have real jobs. Ollie, before I let you get out of here, it's Shitpost. You've listened to the show. You know what I'm about to ask you. What is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
I think it's consistently been, for a while, Catatonic Youths, which is this Instagram. I think they finally have a Twitter page now. And it's just like really bad videos of people playing music, and so sometimes it's like amateur people, and then sometimes it's like videos from the 90s of Creed but like doing really uncomfortable performances at NASCAR races, and phenomenal. Like, everyone should look at it. It's how I decompress.
All right, you'll have to send me one of those. I'll throw it in here at the end. Ollie, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. 508 is where I'm from. 508 is where I'm from. See where I'm from, we don't use no gas and burners. We don't rip no corners. We're straight money earners. We're the seat. Make your whole family mourners.
Splinter has a very simple plea, and this is the story I will leave you with this week. For some reason, Joey Saladino, a.k.a. Joey Salads, he posted his phone number on Twitter for whatever reason. The guy's attention hungry, and I'm sure getting blown up with text messages was, you know, just the type of thing to get him off that day. So he shares his phone number. He has more than 100,000 Twitter followers. I would never do this. And apparently now he's complaining that people are sending him dick pics. So I'm going to join in the chorus of Splinter and say that, you know, you should absolutely not send dick pics to a phone number that reads... Actually, you know what? Bleep that out. I don't want to get accused of harassment. Let's not do that this time. But yeah, if there is an article on Splinter that does have these tweets embedded, which are still live for some fucking reason, if he was getting trolled, you'd think he would delete it. But yeah, do not send Joey Salads your dick pics. Disavow. We do not endorse.
Hey, Jared. Hey, Shitpost listeners. It's Slater. I got a message for everyone. But first, I wanted to comment on the most recent episode. The discussion of Milo Yiannopoulos and the furry convention. I was unaware that being a furry wasn't a weird sex thing. I thought it was definitely a weird sex thing. And so I just wanted to thank you for setting me straight on that. It's absolutely not a weird sex thing. And the more you know. But like I said, I have a big announcement, and that's that the Awful Pundit Tournament, their qualifying rounds, the pundemonium is drawing nearer and nearer as we reach closer and closer to late October, early November. And I wanted to announce that there's going to be a rollout of an Awful Pundit Tournament Patreon with a special limited edition rewards tier for a Big Dave baseball card. And so just... be on the lookout for that. It's going to be coming in the next couple weeks. To follow along with the pundit of the day, Know Your Pundit, that's at Awful Pundits on Twitter. And I just wanted to thank you again for setting me straight on the whole furry issue. Peace out, Jared. Peace out, Shitpost.
And that's going to do it for Shitpost this week. I'm your host, Jared Holt. You can follow me on Twitter at Jared L. Holt. You can support this podcast on Substack. If you can't do that, leave us a nice review in iTunes. It helps us more than you know. Until next week, I'll stay logged on so you can log off. And take care.